So let's talk about traumatic brain injuries. First, we're going to talk about intracranial pressure. So, what is it? It is the force that is measured in your brain CSF compartment. It is made up of brain tissue and intravascular blood, and then your cerebrospinal fluid. Some factors that affect it or influence it are going to be your arterial pressure, your venous pressure, your intra-abdominal and intrathoracic pressures, posture, temperature, blood gases, specifically the CO2. A normal ICP is going to be 5 to 15. If it is sustained over 20, it's abnormal. So there's this Monroe-Kelly doctrine that basically says that if one component of the ICP increases, then another one must decrease when the skull is closed. So if the cerebrospinal fluid increases, then the intravascular blood might decrease. And that's like the normal way that it compensates. But it doesn't always work. And we'll talk about that more. So cerebral blood flow, that's the amount of blood in mils passing through 100 grams of brain tissue in 1 minute. What does that actually mean? This is how if is your brain getting adequate blood flow, essentially. Your brain needs constant oxygen and glucose. So the cerebral autoregulation, that's going to be like the automatic adjustment. So your brain just adjusts itself to make sure that it's getting that constant flow of blood. But it's only helpful if your MAP, like your blood pressure, is normal. So now we're going to talk about our cerebral perfusion. MAP from your ICP. And a normal is going to be 60 to 100. The way that I think of cerebral blood flow, that's like your brain's blood pressure. It's your brain's MAP, right? In intensive care, we look at patients' MAPs a lot, right? If their systolic, is a little bit low, oh, but their MAP is greater than 65, we're good with it. The CPP, the cerebral perfusion pressure, think of it like your brain's MAP. We want it 60 to 100. If it's less than 50, they're going to have some ischemia and neuron death. If it's less than 30, that is incompatible with life. So you get it by subtracting the MAP from the ICP. So now let's talk about increased ICP. What is it? It is something that happens to your brain. There's a lot of different causes, that decreases that cerebral perfusion pressure. So it decreases your brain's quote mean arterial pressure. Some common causes are going to be hematoma, contusion, an abscess. Tumors can do it. Head injury, seizures can do it, strokes can do it. There's a whole lot of different causes. And what happens is causes hypercapnia, so an increase in the carbon dioxide It can cause acidosis. It causes your brain not to be able to regulate all of the things that it normally does, and systemic hypertension. And it can lead to herniation. Herniation is an emergent situation. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But it basically, the pressure gets so big, or not so big. The pressure gets so bad that the brain has nowhere to go except an area where it doesn't need to go. So there's different causes of cerebral edema. There's vasogenic, which is most common, cytotoxic, interstitial. Is that nice to know or is that need to know? My opinion, it's nice to know. Just know that there's a lot of different ways that cerebral edema can happen. And when cerebral edema happens, it can cause an increase in your ICP, which could lead to herniation, which is bad. And I added the like patho map from y'all's book to kind of show you the way it happens. So, clinical manifestations. The first sign that you'll see that there's an increased ICP is going to be a change in the level of consciousness. It might be subtle, it might be dramatic, but that's going to be your first sign. If it gets really high, they can be unconscious and it ultimately would lead to a coma. Vital signs, Cushing's triad. Cushing's triad is what happens to the vital signs when like herniation is on its way to town. You're gonna have a high blood pressure. You're going to have a low heart rate and low respirations. And that's the exact opposite of shock. For shock, it's the opposite. It's tachypnea, it's tachycardia and hypotension. This is hypertension, bradycardia, and bradypnea. If Cushing's triad happens, herniation's knocking on the door. Motor functions. They could have some paralysis. Posturing is a big thing. The biggest posturing is going to be your dacerebrate and your decorticate. So dacerebrate is going to be B. You see the hands are facing outward, and then decorticate turning inwards towards the core. That's how I always remembered it. But that'll start happening when the ICP increases. Their pupils are going to change. They could be sluggish. They might not have a response. If the cause of the increased ICP is like a mass, they could have, unequal pupils. If your pupils are fixed and you have one dilated pupil, that's an emergency. Headaches and vomiting, the headache. So they're gonna have a headache at night. They're gonna have a headache like right when they wake up. The biggest thing about the vomiting is it is projectile vomiting that's not preceded by nausea. It's not like they're, oh, I'm so nauseous, and then they yak. It is just out of nowhere projectile vomiting. So here's y'all a little picture about the signs of increased ICP. Another thing, so for infants, they're gonna have the bulging fontanelles. They might have that suture separation, and then the Like, most prominent one for them is going to be a high-pitched cry. Diagnostic studies. We want to figure out what's causing the increase in the ICP. So, CT, MRI, show us if there's a mass, if there's a stroke that's causing it. NEEG will show us if a seizure's causing it. They might need transcranial Doppler studies to see the blood flow to the brain. If a patient has increased ICP, a lumbar puncture is contraindicated. And that is forever and ever, amen. No lumbar punctures for somebody with increased ICP. Let's talk about monitoring them. So this picture on the left is a drain. It was in my unit, the cardiac unit, I must say. I hope y'all know that I called up to neuro and I said, y'all gotta come help me because this don't look like something we stick in the heart. So what does it do? It is a little drain that goes into the brain. And we attach it to a transducer, which is that little thing with all the numbers and then all the wires. And it gives us a direct and constant read on our monitors. So for this patient, where this picture of the drain is, I'm trying to remember. He had some kind of stroke, and he was a young guy. And he had increased ICP from too much fluid buildup. They put the drain in because it gave us the constant reading of the ICP, but it would also help regulate it because if it got too high, like the valve on the drain would open up and the fluid would come out to try to regulate it. But he had the classic signs. So he had a bowel movement. We had to get him cleaned up. Everybody knows that when you get somebody cleaned up, you gotta lay them back a little bit. And it was ICP on the monitor, shot up. He became unconscious. We sat him back up and he came back too. And then later that day, it was the same thing. I don't know what he was altered mental status from all of the buildup. And so I don't know what he did, but it was like projectile vomiting, no nausea. So there's our little story of how I had to pretend to be a neuro nurse one time. He ended up being fine, by the way. So the goals of the ICP, it's going to support the brain function, yes, but also find the cause and fix it. We want to keep the oxygen at 100 millimeters per mercury or greater, and or keep the carbon dioxide normal, so that's 35 to 45. And they might need to be intubated just to be able to provide them with the oxygen support that they need. If there is a mass or a tumor, we want to surgically remove it if we can. So, some other things that we give, mannitol. It's an osmotic diuretic. Essentially, it tries to pull some fluid off the brain and they pee it out. So we want to monitor their urine output, their kidney function, their electrolytes. It also can cause pulmonary edema. So that would be something else that you would want to monitor with mannitol. Not only do you measure like the specific electrolytes, that's going to be sodium and the serum osmolality. So you check those before you administer mannitol. Mannitol can also crystallize. So it's got to stay warm or it'll crystallize, and you cannot administer it if it's crystallized. Just a little fun fact. When pharmacy sends it up to you, if you stick it in your pocket, it usually, and it's close enough to you, the body heat will keep it warm enough to keep it from crystallizing. So hypertonic saline, it's going to have the same concept of the mannitol. So this is your 3% saline. And a lot of it, the things that you would do for mannitol, you're going to do for the 3%. You're going to monitor your sodium. You're going to also monitor your blood pressure. That's going to be a big one too, because you're not going to administer it if their sodium's high, because then that causes fluid retention, and that does the opposite of what we need it to do. Corticosteroids. This can help with edema around like tumors or abscesses, but it's not recommended for traumatic brain injuries. So these people should also have like Pepcid or Protonix on board to help prevent GI bleeding. Corticosteroids, we know that they increase your blood sugar. We're going to watch that. We're going to watch for signs and symptoms of infection. And nutrition is always important, no matter what the disease process is. Malnutrition actually makes cerebral edema worse. Their body is like in a hypermetabolic state. So, once again, we want to start feeding them as early as possible and whatever means we need to. If they can't eat and we have to do enteral or parenteral nutrition, we will. So, assessment. To your left is from your book. It is just a pupil assessment that you've all probably done 100 times at this point. And on our right is our Glasgow Coma Scale or GCS. This is a very quick way to get a neuro assessment. So you assess different things, and you give it a score. And whatever their score is, just that number alone is going to tell us a lot of information about their neurological status. For instance, if you go in there and you ask them to open their eyes, or if you go in there, let me just pause, rewind. You go in there, hey, Mr. Smith, and they open their eyes, they get a 4 in that top box. Mr. Smith, can you tell me what day it is, or where you are? If they're able to answer that, they get a 5. So far their score is 9. That's awesome. But if not, you're going to give them the number that correlates with how they respond to these. Motor response, squeeze my hands. If they don't do that, they don't get 6 points for that. 8 or less is we an interventions has to that person's in a coma. 15 is a perfect score. 8 or less is coma, and then a 3 is totally unresponsive. But it is a very quick, like 30-second way to find out a lot about your patient and their neurological status. Once again, I gave y'all some things to remember. What are we going to do for somebody with increased ICP? Well, the cough, we're going to teach them to not do these things. So these are all things that can increase their ICP. So coughing, that's going to increase the pressure in their brain. We want to control their temperature because being hypothermic or hyperthermic can also increase ICP. Don't blow your nose with excessive force. We want to keep their neck and their hip in midline position. So we're going to tell them not to, have extreme flexion or extension. And then we don't want hypercapnia. We talked about that. We want our carbon dioxide in a normal range, so that's the 35 to 45 millimeters per mercury. So we don't want the cough. What we do want to do is the perfuse. So head of bed at 30 degrees, head in a midline position. Like I told y'all earlier, we had that patient that we did not even lay flat, but it was less than 30 degrees, and immediately his ICP went up and he went unconscious. So you want to keep their head of bed elevated. We're going to evaluate their airway. When we reposition them, you want to log roll them because we don't want their neck or hip in extreme flexion extension positions. We want to start feedings early and also assess swallow function. We're going to avoid the use of anything really cold, any restrictive clothing, also nicotine. We want to promote safety and seizure precautions and assess the skin integrity. And then we're going to evaluate the ICP often and also eliminate constipation. You don't want them bearing down. So now let's talk about head injuries. So, what is a head injury? It's an injury to the head. And a bad injury to the head is a traumatic brain injury. There's a whole lot of different causes. Your motor vehicle accidents are going to be the most common, but also falls, firearms, assaults. Sports-related trauma is a huge one, especially like football or boxing, war-related injuries. Recreational injuries. There's different types. You can have a scalp laceration, you can have a skull fracture, or head trauma. So the scalp lacerations, it's gonna be easy to recognize. You're gonna see them bleeding. The head is very vascular. They're gonna bleed a lot. That's the major complication, is just the blood loss and the risk of infection. So skull fractures can be a whole lot of different things. It is going to depend on the velocity and the momentum and direction and shape of what hit them on impact to cause it, as well as location, because the location is going to determine the signs and symptoms. The biggest complications with skull fractures are going to be intracranial infections, because we've just broken that protective barrier to protect the brain, a hematoma, or brain tissue damage. I would say that's a pretty big one. And then head trauma, this can be like a contusion or a concussion. So these are the different types of skull fractures. There's a whole lot of them, if you can't tell. There's a whole table about it. They all have, let me choose my words. Is it nice to know or is it need to know? Kind of a little bit of both, but I would say it's more nice to know. Except for, like, I would want to know that a compound skull fracture is, that's going to be a severe head injury, right? But it might be nice to know some other things about other types of skull fractures. But ultimately, a compound fracture, that's going to be pretty important, pretty severe. But the manifestations is going to depend on, the area that was hit, what it was hit with. So I'll leave that like that. So let's talk about some manifestations. So diffuse injury, that's like concussions, okay? I'm pretty sure we all know what concussions are, so I'm not gonna bore y'all with that. But post-concussion syndrome, that's 2 weeks to 3 months after the injury, and it looks like a persistent headache. They can have like personality or behavior changes, a shortened attention span, decreased short-term memory. So we all know what concussion is, but the post-concussion syndrome, they're still having effects up, 3 months after the injury. So a diffuse, an occipital injury, sorry. So that's going to occur after a traumatic brain injury. It takes up to, or it takes 12 to 24 hours to develop, and then the clinical signs, they vary, but it's pretty severe. This is like a lack of oxygen to the brain. They're gonna have increased ICP, posturing, the cerebral edema, all the things that we've talked about previously. So a focal injury, could be a laceration or a hematoma or a contusion. The lacerations, that is tearing of the brain tissue that causes severe tissue damage. Surgery is impossible just because of the brain tissue itself. But what we want to do is prevent infection and further injury from ICP. So we want to control the ICP so that it doesn't cause further trauma. A contusion is going to be associated with a closed head injury. The picture below is an example. So the best way I know how to say it is like the brain rattling around in the skull, right? So it could cause bleeding or infarction and then ultimately edema. So some complications, epidural hematoma, subdural hematoma, and intracerebral hematoma. All of these are bleedings in different areas of the brain. So a complication of a head injury or traumatic brain injury is going to be bleeding somewhere in the brain. Epidural, that's important. That's an emergency. They're going to have an initial period of unconsciousness, and then they're going to become lucid, and then they're just going to go back kind of unconscious. They're going to have a decrease in their level of consciousness. They're going to have a headache, nausea, vomiting. Subdural, I mean, it can be acute or chronic. And then the intracerebral is gonna, the outcome of the patient is gonna be determined by the size and location of the hematoma. But just know a complication of a head injury can be bleeding somewhere in the brain, and an epidural bleed, epidural hematoma, is a medical emergency. So, how do we fix it? There's a table for emergency management, that is 61.9. ABCs, always. Airway, breathing, circulation. And then, the S is for safety. We're going to give them oxygen. We want to control the bleeding with a sterile dressing because remember, we've just broken the barrier of protection to the brain. You want to stabilize the cervical spine with a cervical collar or, and or we want it to be in a backboard. You want to remove their clothing because you want to assess for any other injuries. Two large bore IV access. You want to make sure that they maintain a normal temperature, and then we're going to intubate them if their GCS is less than 8, because remember we said that they're in a coma if it's less than 8. So, our goals for these patients, we want their brain to get oxygenated and perfused, essentially. Another important one is just maintaining that like maximum cognition, motor, and sensory function. A lot of teaching goes into traumatic brain injuries in the prevention aspect of it. You know, teaching different populations and ages of car and motorcycle safety. Also, like little kids riding a bike. That's very important. Wear a helmet. So there's a lot of different like community teachings that could go into help preventing traumatic brain injuries. Acute care. So they might need emergency surgery. You want to make sure that you stay calm and gentle whenever you're communicating with the patient and their family. Table 6111 has a whole bunch of patient teaching on it. You don't want a fever. You don't want shivering either. You don't want a fever. A little NCLEX tidbit. NCLEX. From a patient's ear. And that's what this is, leaking CSF. If you see fluid leaking, clear fluid, test it for glucose. If it's positive, it is CSF. And then specific measures for the immobilized patient, that's gonna, you know, we've kind of already talked about a lot of this because it all kind of runs together, but that is gonna be your like VTE prophylaxis. That's going to be your stress ulcer prophylaxis. That is going to be your pressure injury prophylaxis. That's going to be making sure that their cervical spine stays in a midline neutral position. Outside of the acute care portion, you know, they might have chronic motor or sensory communication or memory deficits. They might have different kind of nutrition problems. They might not be able to swallow. You know, they might need a long-term solution to get nutrition. This can cause seizure disorders. And then, of course, the emotional support aspect of it as well. So, like I said, they might need emergency surgery. A common one is a burr hole. It, think of it, so too much fluid has built up in the brain. They drill a hole to release that pressure. A craniotomy can also relieve increased ICP, and a craniectomy can do the same thing. I'm trying to remember. So my, I grew up playing competitive soccer, and I had a soccer coach who, I think it was a car wreck that he had had, like a long time ago. And like a long, long time ago now, because I was like 12 when this happened. And he had had a craniectomy. And so he was missing part of his skull on the back of his head. And it was the beginning of practice. And we had literally done one drill. And he was trying to move us all to the other side of the soccer field, and The goalie, we had to get all of like the balls and the cones and everything. She had punted the ball to get it over there, or one of them. Well, he wasn't paying attention, and the ball came and hit him right on that spot where he did not have his goal. No good. So, canceled practice right there on the spot, and he ended up being fine, thank God. But he did. He had to go to the hospital and have it checked out. So, if your patient, has one of these surgeries, make sure that we're teaching them safety in the afterward. So, what does it mean for a nurse if your patient has brain surgery? Frequently assessing, always. Nausea and vomiting might be common. We don't want them to vomit. That can increase their ICP. We also don't want them to be in pain. We want the head of the bed elevated. We want to turn them to prevent any kind of pressure injuries, but also remember always log roll. Keep an eye on the fluid and electrolytes. You're going to keep an eye on the surgical dressings. And you want to provide range of motion as well. Especially if they're not able to do active, you want to do passive.